This is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, I don't know what your reading material was like during vacation. I pathologically try to avoid what's going on in the news. I successfully avoided 99% of the Republican convention, except for Governor Romney's acceptance speech. I did hear more of the Democratic convention, including former President Clinton's speech. Reading material, The History of World War II by Winston Churchill, an exciting adventure called China Run, another one which is a fantasy called Aragon. And also The History of the Inquisition. See, I avoided anything that had to do with the show. How'd you do on yours?
You know, I decided to do the same thing. I mean, after all that series of interviews we did, I just wanted to unwind. I read Tom Clancy's book. I tell you, he's back at it, 800 pages. Vince Flynn, Brad Thor, all geopolitical thrillers. But there was one book that I wanted to read just out of curiosity, because we've been talking a lot during this segment on lifetime income, and it was called The Seven Most Important Equations for Your Retirement by Moshe Malevsky.
Good Irish name.
Good Irish name. But, you know, what struck me about this is, as a CFP, a lot of the formulas that we use in our retirement planning software, John, a lot of these I just sort of took for granted. In fact, if you were a finance major, you took a finance course, a lot of the present value calculations, a lot of things that we do in finance today, I didn't realize go all the way back to the 11th and 12th century. And what this book is about, the gentleman that wrote the book is a professor at York University with graduate degrees in finance and mathematics. He talked about how these formulas are really used in retirement, because I always took these formulas for granted. And what this book did is talk about, where did these formulas originate? They came from various authors, but they really address some of the main questions that individuals that are getting ready to retire or are currently in retirement now face in dealing with if or when they can retire. You know, we covered this, I think, on the last program we did in terms of planning for retirement. Number one, can I afford it? Number two, is it the right time? Number three, how is this going to impact spouse and family? Four, do I want to retire? In some of the fears that people have, will I outlive my income? How much income will I need? And it was a fascinating view of how these formulas were really put together, and they go back as far as a gentleman by the name of Leonardo Pisani Bonacci, who most people in finance today know him as his name Fibonacci. But some of the formulas that we use today in terms of how long your money will last, that was developed in the 12th century.
You know, if you started into this, say, 10 years ago, we would be framing this probably in an entirely different manner, because I don't think anybody planning back then to, say, retire yesterday would have foreseen two bear markets within one decade, the precipitous drop in housing prices. You remember, that's the one asset that never went down. That's your ultimate security there. Or even worse now, 0% interest rates hanging below inflation rate. So you're in a losing proposition there. Nobody foresaw that.
No. And what's interesting is this book, there's seven equations, which is the title. And it really deals with the questions that people have to face in retirement. How long will my number last? In other words, if I've got a pot of money, you get a lump sum from a pension fund, you know, how long is this money going to last you? And the formula that we use in planning today was really developed by Leonardo Fibonacci. And that goes back, John, to the 12th century. Another formula is, how long will I spend in retirement? This is really sort of an actuarial computation. And that goes back to the 18th century. Actually, he had a formula named after him, Benjamin Gompertz, who really developed formulas or actuarial formulas. He was studying obituaries, trying to find out how long will people last. Boy, here's a big issue. Is a pension annuity worth it? And a lot of individuals today that are working for companies, when they get ready to retire, they either can take their pension plan in the form of a lump sum, or some companies may offer employees, for example, an annuity payment over their lifetime or that of their spouse. Believe it or not, the formula that we use to compute that was invented by Edmund Halley, the famous astronomer, Halley's Comet named after him. He invented the formula in terms of whether you should take a lump sum or you should take an annuity payment. And then going back to this century, a very famous economist in the 20s and 30s, Irving Fisher, what is the proper spending rate that you should spend in retirement? And we're going to discuss these. We're not going to talk about the formulas. Obviously, this is radio, and the formulas would bore you to death. More importantly is what these formulas tell you. There's the economist Paul Samuelson, how much in risky stocks versus safe cash. Solomon Huebner, in terms of what is your financial legacy today? And a Russian name that I'm not even going to try to pronounce, even though I'm partly Russian, is my current plan sustainable? So it's really amazing when you take a look at this, the stuff that we're using today to plan for retirement, financial formulas were invented centuries ago.
Well, obviously, Jim, this is radio. I mean, you could hold the formulas up to the microphone and say, here they are. Okay. It's not a classroom, but let's see if we can do this. If people want to, they can read the book and maybe apply the formulas. But could we at least discuss concepts that come into play here? Say, for example, the whole concept of anticipating longevity.
Well, you know, this is interesting because in the 17th century, a lot of the kings throughout Europe would borrow money from their subjects. And what they would do is they would issue an annuity to their subjects. So if you loan the crown, let's just take a hypothetical example, $10,000, the crown would say, okay, we're going to give you an annuity of X amount of dollars per month for the rest of your life. Well, nobody had done any computations in terms of longevity, the rate of interest the crown would have to pay. And there was a gentleman by the name of Benjamin Gompertz who basically was self-educated, because back in England during the 18th century, those who were educated, a lot of it was held strictly due to race and religion in your class in terms of who could attend a university. And he was Jewish, so he was not allowed to attend college because of his religious creed. And so he's basically, he was a self-educated individual, but this guy was so smart and was so advanced in mathematics, he was later admitted to the British scientific aristocracy. But basically, he came up with a formula. He started studying statistics, how long people lived, and it was amazing some of the things that he came up with. I mean, let's face it, how many people want to sit around and study the obituaries? But that's what actuaries do. And what he did is through his study, because the crown wanted to know, look, we're issuing all these annuities for the money that we're raising. We need to know how long we're going to have to pay out on these things. And he came up with the probability of dying in each year, and it was logarithmic scale. But basically, the chance of dying increases approximately 9% per year from each adult class. And basically, if I was to summarize this, let's say a 46-year-old between age 46 and 47, there's a certain percentage increase of that person dying in the following year. Now, remember, health standards were much, much different. People didn't live as long as they do today back in the, let's say, the 17th and 18th century. But basically, it's the actuarial formula that we use, as we've been talking about in the program, that the average couple today retiring in their early 60s, between a husband and wife, could plan on spending between the two of them at least 25 years in retirement. And he came up with a formula that we use today. I mean, it's used in computer software programs. And it talked about the probability or the ages of, for example, if you are age 60, what is the probability that you'll live to age 85? Well, it age 60, the probability that you would live to age 85 is 48%. If you are age 60, the probability that you will live to 90 is about 28%, and living to 95 would be about 11%. So these are actuarial tables, but they're very important because, you know, one of the questions you're going to have to ask if you're planning for retirement, how long will I need my money to last?
So we see that Gompers was really the first actuary that we have record of anyway. And you need to look at this when you're looking at longevity. I know with your clients, you have them do a health questionnaire, which is provided to an actuarial firm, and they calculate not only longevity, but also the medical costs that you're going to spend during that time.
And that's a very important thing because Gompertz gave us the actuarial tables in terms of what your longevity is. The second equation is, okay, I've got a pot of money. How long is that money going to last given the interest rate in my withdrawal rate? And that formula came from basically Pisano Bonacci in this book. The professor calls him Leonardo Fibonacci, which is what he's known because of the formula sequence that he came up with. And it's like a logarithmic scale. And what you do is you plug in the amount of money you have and the interest rate that you're earning on the funds that you have invested. And basically, John, it tells you almost to the month how long your money's going to last and when you're going to run out. And it's one of the things that we use in retirement planning when somebody comes up with, you know, their basic expenses. We run this simulation and it tells us, okay, you're withdrawing or you need to have this amount of money to support your retirement lifestyle. Based on what returns are, based on the amount of money you have, we can actually predict and say, you know what, you're age 60 right now. So based on the numbers, we can actually predict when you're going to run out of money. And it gives you a probability of success. And then that way we can, you know, either play around with the formula and say, well, if we reduce expenses, if you wait a couple more years to retirement, if you shift a little bit more into different investments. But basically, John, the formula that we use in our retirement software was basically one of these formulas was based on Leonardo Fibonacci going back to the 12th century.
You really trust the guy whose name begins with Fib.
Well, remember, his name was Bonacci.
Right.
They added the Fib because that's what
they called us for. Because he always Actually, for most people, if you're a mathematician, you recognize the Fibonacci sequence where it's an integer sequence and it's where every number is the sum of the two numbers that went before it. That's what a Fibonacci sequence is. But I don't know if it applies here or not. I haven't seen the...
Well, we use it in technical analysis in terms of a big upward move or downward move. There's this Fibonacci sequence in terms of the retracement on the correction. So, I mean, that formula is used in retirement planning. It's used in technical analysis today and analyzing markets. It's amazing. But the formulas were invented in the 12th century.
But a lot of people today, Jim, don't have a defined benefit pension. In reality, there's your lump sum when you retire, or they get an annuity from the company. How's that going to fit into Mr. Fib's theories here?
Mr. Why do you keep calling him Fib?
What? It just strikes me, you know, Fibonacci is a great Irish name, but, you know.
Okay. Well, the next formula came from a gentleman by the name of Edwin Halley, and everybody knows him as the famous astronomer. And as I mentioned earlier, the crown in England was financing a lot of its deficits through annuities, and they were issuing annuities. And so they needed to have a formula in terms of, should I take a lump sum, in other words, just have a bond, or should I take an annuity payment? And you think about it, John, this is exactly what so many boomers, I mean, if you work for the federal government or a state government, you probably have a defined benefit pension plan. You know exactly what you're going to have when you retire. But a lot of boomers say working in the private sector don't have those defined benefit plans. They went out the window back in the early 80s, and we went to defined contribution plans, which basically is a lump sum of money. So when you face retirement, the company says, all right, here's this bucket of money. You can take it in a lump sum, or You can take it in a series of annuity payments over your lifetime or a percentage going to your surviving spouse. And I mean, there's a lot of questions that have to be asked. There's seven of them that are really important in terms of taking a lump sum or selecting a life annuity. One, let's talk about overall flexibility. Obviously, if you invest the money any way you want and spend more or less, you have more flexibility than just a fixed payment that begins when you retire. It never changes. The other thing is guarantees and promise. The one thing about annuity payments is you get income for the rest of your life and your spouse's life that can't be outlived. In other words, you remove the risk of longevity with an annuity payment. It's one of the reasons that we use immediate annuities to supplement people's income to basically meet their essential needs. You know, if you take it in a lump sum, you may not have that. Legacy value. When you get annuity payment from your company, that let's say they're going to give you X amount of dollars to you and then X amount to your surviving spouse. But when the last spouse passes away, there's nothing left. Whereas in a legacy, if you take a lump sum, you may have a pot of money in an IRA or in a personal asset account that you could pass on to your heirs. Decision complexity. There's nothing really to manage when you take an annuity payment. Every single month, the check is sent to you. You don't have to follow the investment markets. You don't have to worry about stocks are up or down, what's going on with interest rates. Inflation protection. That depends on how you invest your money. If you invest your money and take it in a lump sum, obviously you might be able to put it in some things that can go up with inflation, stocks, gold, or things like that, where, you know, usually with the fixed payment annuity, you don't have that option. Although some of the insurance companies now are offering a inflation protection where the payments can go up 2 to 3% a year. Credit and safety. If you take the money in a lump sum, and you're going to see in a case that we're going to talk today, we call this couple the Armageddons. What happened when they got a lump sum from the sale of a business, the risk that can take place. And then finally, health implications. If a couple is in very poor health, taking a lump sum is obviously a better option than taking a, let's say, monthly income, because if you're in poor health and you don't live long, then, you know, that big lump sum, that's not going to go to your heirs. It's going to be kept with the insurance company. So a lot of these questions were resolved with a formula that basically took a look at the probabilities, the rate of return, and basically there was a formula that they computed. And I'm just going to give you an example here. Let's assume that you're 70 years old and you're entitled to a pension annuity of $3,000 per month starting immediately. And further assume that the employer, instead of offering you $3,000 a month, would offer you a payment, a lump sum payment of $306,000. Now, $3,000 a month is $36,000 a year. If you divide that into, let's say, $306,000, the factor is 8.5 times the annual income. And this table that Haley came up with, it actually shows you really what the rate of return is on your money given your life expectancy. So, John, this was a really important issue because this is probably one of the biggest decisions that a lot of retired individuals face today, either taking a lump sum or taking an annuity payment. And at the same time, one of the things we hear over and over again is, boy, I don't want to lock everything up. I would like some flexibility. I'd like to leave something to my heirs. And those seven questions that we talked about, flexibility, guarantees, legacy, decision complexity, inflation protection, credit safety, and health implications, all of these factors go into this retirement planning sequence.
Okay, the last formula that we're keying in on here right now is, what should your spending rate be? How do you adjust that for whatever your income will be in the future?
This one, which I found is rather interesting, and I never looked at it in this way, and that is, it really depends on your health and your own longevity risk factor. In other words, if you're in real good health and you're saying to yourself, you know what? I think I'm going to live to be 85 or 90. My mother and father lived well into their 80s. I had one client that lived, gosh, when he was 97 when he passed away. And gosh, I thought he was going to be a centurion, but he didn't. But, you know, it depends on how you view your own mortality. Obviously, if you're very optimistic, you think, boy, longevity runs in our family. You know, I'm in very good health. I exercise. I eat well. We've got a history. Now, obviously, no one can predict some unforeseen accident or something. It tells you what your spending rate is. If you are very optimistic about your health, longevity, you have a history of longevity, then obviously you're going to need your money to last a longer period of time. So your rate of spending will be obviously less because you expect you're going to live 25, 30 years in your retirement. On the other hand, if you're not as optimistic about your health or longevity running in the family, then you would want to spend more in the early years of your retirement versus the latter years of the retirement. Because let's face it, you can't predict how long you're going to live. And therefore, you might be more apt to say, boy, I'd rather spend a few more bucks today, take that trip that I wanted to take, do some things I want to do today, because I don't know if I will be around 10, 20 years later to do these things. And so there's a formula for that, which we also have. And that came from the economist Irving Fisher. Now, there's a bunch of other formulas in the book, and we just simply don't have the time to discuss them in terms of what should your financial legacy be. Is your current plan sustainable? These are a lot of questions that we address and will be addressing here on the program in the weeks and the months ahead.
Now we move into our real life example. We've been doing this ever since this Lifetime Income series began, and we're going to look at the case of Richard and Joan Disaster. By the way, the purpose of this is to show you what happens if you start flying without a plan and then things do not go according to the plan that you didn't have, and then you start panicking. So Mr. and Mrs. Disaster here started a business, and ultimately they got to the point where they wanted to sell the business, that had become prosperous. So the contract for sale agreed that they would get paid half up in front, and the other half of what the business was worth would be payable over a 10-year period. That's how this note was going to be carried. Now, their idea, it seemed logical at the time, was to invest money, to make it grow, to live off the note payment that would come in over the 10-year period, and take the lump sum and invest it, and then theoretically by the end of 10 years, they'd have enough invested and accumulated whereby they could retire on that. Well, that was probably 10 years ago or so. And as you well know, the market has been a cataclysmic series of disasters. They really needed to have had someone managing their investments. They either needed help on the investments with planning advice or at least recognized the fact that this was ultimately their life savings and they needed to invest it conservatively. What happened is they saw their gains evaporate. They lost a portion of their principal. They made classic mistakes, sold stocks at the bottom in panic, liquidated some of their real estate holdings, sold bonds in 2010, and then began chasing the gold market and got hammered in debt. So that's flying without a plan, and that's why a plan's so important.
Yeah, I think the real key here, John, and just to put this into perspective, you know, this goes back to the year 2004. Now, this was a couple that built a chain of Mexican food restaurants in Northern California. When they opened their fourth restaurant, which was also successful, they got a buyout offer. And they were offered $3 million for the sale of the restaurant, half up front, and the other half of payments of $150,000 a year over a 10-year period. Now, I think, just to kind of frame this, think back to the year 2004. We had just come out of the tech bubble. Greenspan was slashing interest rates. The housing market was heating up. I mean, people were making fortunes. You remember the covers of Fortune magazine about, you know, individual investors buying large tracts? You know, I can remember in Fortune magazine, a 28-year-old was featured in the magazine, and he was going to places like Phoenix and literally going into a new housing tract and buying 5-10 homes. I mean, that was the market at that time, and also the stock market was doing well. And in 2004, Richard and Joan. Richard was age 58. Joan was age 55. And they got an offer from a larger restaurant chain to buy out their business. And, you know, here they're offered $3 million. Now, if you take the $3 million, half of which they got up front, in payments of $150,000 a year, added to their other assets, which were significant. They had close to over $1 million in investments, which was their pensions, personal investments that they had put aside. And their plan, John, was to basically, this may seem strange for those living in California, but they would sell their home in Northern California, move down to Southern California to be with two of their children. And the idea is homes in San Diego, expensive as they were a lot less expensive than they were in the Bay Area. And it's amazing that they were able to sell their home, come down here to San Diego, pay cash for a house, and have money left over. Now, let me frame some of the things that I think their first mistake was. Their first mistake was, okay, Richard was 58 at the time the business was sold. Joan was age 55. The first thing that at least I would urge anybody to do, whether your business gets bought out, you come into a windfall, I don't know, you win the lottery, you come into an inheritance, or you get, you know, an early retirement incentive from your company, is to formulate a plan. And I'm talking about being specific. How much income am I going to need? You know, how long is the money expected to last? What are my health conditions? And also, you know, to think of the fact that, all right, in this couple, in the case of Richard and Joan, they were heading into retirement. It would have been different. I have a lot of entrepreneurs that have gotten their businesses bought out at early ages. They're still young enough. They have a long working career ahead of them that they could fall back on if, let's say, things didn't work out. But in this case, Richard was 58. And the only plan, John, was to invest it. The idea was, okay, we're going to get this payment of $150,000 a year. We have a free and clear home. This will allow us to live the lifestyle that we like. And we will take this money, our personal investments, the money left over after paying cash for a house and selling their house in Northern California, and we will invest this money over a 10-year period. So hopefully, at the end of 10 years, that, you know, this money would grow to a point where they could live. And if you think back to 2004, and I'm just going to shorten this story, what they did is they ended up buying a bunch of single-family homes. They ended up with six single-family homes, and they put their personal investments, were invested in stocks roughly, I think they told me it was like 60, 65% in stocks, the rest in bonds. Now, you know, if you take a look at a couple just retiring, given the fact that Richard was 58 and Joan was 55, a 60, 65% portfolio in stocks is very reasonable. They were mainly stock mutual funds.
Yeah, it seems like, Jim, as you're describing it here, because obviously I didn't know them, that what they didn't really recognize that this was their life savings, and you have to be prudent when you make the investment. I've wondered about that on a number of occasions with different people I've been privy to, and that some kind of a plan was really essential to making this thing happen.
This was a very successful couple. They were entrepreneurs, and what they did, and you got to remember what was going on at this time. People were getting rich off real estate, home prices, especially in California, which were going up 15 to 20% a year. And what they did is instead of taking time to really study the markets, understand what was going on. Remember, Greenspan lowered interest rates down to 1%. Interest rates were at historical low levels. And housing, I mean, when you think about it, you know, how could you ever lose money in housing? I mean, for half a century, the one staple in investing was real estate, the single family home. You could never go wrong by buying a house. So, I mean, they launched right into, I think they told me, and I'm not going to mention the course they took. It was basically, John, an infomercial on television. They ordered the books and tapes. And of course, you were going to become a gazillionaire by investing in real estate. And that's what they ended up doing. They ended up buying in about a 15-month period of time, six properties. So they end up spending almost $3 million on purchases of real estate, taking on almost $1.8 million in debt. They invested the after-tax proceeds from the business into real estate. And, you know, for a while, things worked. I think they told me that at the peak of the market before real estate collapsed, that $3 million investment in real estate was worth $4 million at the end of 2007. And their personal assets of $1.5 million got up to, I think, a peak of $2.1 million. So like anything else in the last decade, the first 4 or 5 years, I mean, people were making money in real estate. They were making money in stocks. They were making money in bonds. And I think that's, you know, looking at this case, I think the biggest mistake they made is they never had a plan. And it was like, okay, I've got this lump sum payment. And this is what happens to a lot of people. They get a lump sum payment. All of a sudden, they get a notice from the company. They're going to get an early retirement package. Maybe they're getting laid off. They're getting an early retirement incentive. If you retire early, we're going to make it more beneficial. We're going to give you a lump sum. Or, you know, as in this case, with this couple, your business is bought out. And all of a sudden, you have this big wad of money. And it's like, oh, I got to get it invested. The stock market's going up. People are making a fortune in real estate. Instead of really sitting back and say, okay, we're 58, Jones 55. This is our life savings. This is what we've worked our entire life to build up. That gives you a different perspective when you think about your portfolio rather than we got to get this money invested. And I think, John, that was the real critical case here.
If you look at what they did, remember you talked about forming a budget, the essential things in your budget, then the bucket list part of your budget, having that plan, sticking to the plan. How do you do it? How do you adjust for changes in market environments? They never did all of that. And so this is where you wind up when you don't do it.
Yeah. And that's why you'll hear this process repeated over and over during our Lifetime Income series, because one of the key things in planning your retirement is really to take your retirement in 5-year increments, because I can tell you what you're spending money on today is going to be different 5 years from now. And when you take a look at your budget and you boil it down to, boy, this is what I need on a monthly basis. I need $5,000 a month, $6,000, $7,000, $10,000, whatever that number is. This is what I need every single month. This is what I call my bucket list or my hope for list. Boy, if I had some extra money, these are the things I'd like to do, and this is how much they're going to cost. The trip to Europe, 10 grand, gifts to grandkids, whatever they are. And then also take into consideration your life expectancy, your health, and future medical cost and inflation cost. And that's what this couple didn't do, because what I would have done is sat down and say, you know, what is it going to cost you to live? Let's take a portion of the pie and direct it in a direction that guarantees or assures you that you're going to have this money for the rest of your life. You're not going to be able to outlive it, because in this couple's case, they had a 10-year note that they knew was going to end in 10 years. That $150,000 a year income was going to end. So that would have been the first thing. The second thing I would have done is say, all right, what are the things you really want to do? You know, the trips or the special things, and then put together a portion of the portfolio that met those goals. And then finally, the third portion of the planning process would have been either to have some kind of inflation protection or something that would take care of future cost of living increases, whether it was due to medical or down the road, one spouse becomes extremely sick, gets dementia, and takes care of those needs. And it's amazing. We talked about this a while back, how very few people end up retiring without a plan, John. Usually the plan is, okay, you know, I want to do this during retirement. I'm going to spend this kind of money, but they never really sit down, analyze it, and plan for these contingencies, because the way you look at your portfolio when you retire has to be much different than when you look at your portfolio during your working career, when you have the youth, you have the years ahead of you to handle market fluctuations, to handle losses, as this couple went through with real estate, the stock market, the bond market. You know, if I could emphasize one thing through this series, it is, If you are thinking retiring, I don't care if it's 5 years, 10 years from now, have a plan. And if you don't have one, start putting together one now, because this is a totally different investment environment today than, as John, as you mentioned at the beginning of this segment, if we were doing this segment 10, 12 years ago, nobody would think about two bear markets in stocks, 0% interest rates, or the fact that the single family home would lose value.
We're going to continue this lifetime income series, hopefully with more successful outcomes than with Mr. and Mrs. Disaster here. What topics will we cover in future weeks?
Next week's going to be a really important program. We're going to have two special guests on the program, and we're going to deal with two issues, and that is leaving a legacy, estate taxes, probate, incapacity. So I'm going to have an estate planning expert. And remember, if nothing changes, the estate tax exemption goes from $5 million this year. It drops down to $1 million next year. And the estate tax rate goes from 35% to 55%. So we're going to have an estate tax lawyer on the program. And then another issue that we deal with all the time, and that is having a trustee. Who should you pick as your trustee? Should it be the kids or should it be a corporate trustee? What are the issues you're going to deal with in succession planning, whether you own a business or you're trying to leave money to your children? So we're going to have two specialists on the program in the Lifetime Income Series. That's coming up next week, John.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. Because we have been taking time off over the last couple of weeks, we've gotten backlogged in our queue line, so we have quite a few to get through today. Please remember, when you call into the queue lines, which toll-free, U.S. and Canada, is 800-794-6480, 800-794-6480. Please keep your calls at or below a minute. They're starting to drift over and become doctoral theses again, so you don't want to do that. Financial Sense News Hour is for information and for educational purposes only, and you should not consider what you hear on the program to be in a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell securities. And when we respond to your emails and your questions on the queue lines, they're based on the personal opinions of Jim Poplava. And because we don't know a lot about you, we can't take into account your suitability, your objectives, or your risk tolerance. And because of this, because we're for educational purposes only, we are not liable to any person for financial losses resulting from investing in companies profiled on the Financial Sense News Hour. You should have an advisor who, first of all, shares your economic philosophy, and then who can give you wise advice about what you wish to do with your money and your investments.
Hey, gentlemen, it's John, one of your loyal listeners from Austin, Texas. Jim, you being what I consider my fallback guy to sensible information having to do with peak oil, I wanted to ask you what you thought about this. Now, I'm hearing a handful of people talk about the United States will be energy independent within 4 or 5 years. And this handful of people even includes the sensible John Malden, who I just heard on an interview claiming that. So it seems to me if we're using 23 million barrels of oil a day, roughly, and we're producing 10, and even in the last few years we've increased that by maybe somewhere around 3 million barrels a day because of the boom in natural gas, we still got a deficit of 10 million barrels of oil a day to go, and I don't see how that can happen. And even if in 4 or 5 years we've increased production another few million, the rate of depletion of these wells using the new horizontal drilling technology is so much greater than the older depletion that it seems that we're fighting a losing battle. So I would like very much to hear your opinion on whether the United States is going to be energy independent in the next 4 or 5 years. And don't misunderstand me. I would like for that to happen, but I think we need to be realistic. Thank you.
John, no way that's going to happen. I mean, we're still importing a significant amount of our energy needs in this country. Now, we've had some good news in the sense that shale oil production, we've been able to increase production as a result of horizontal drilling and shale by almost 1 million barrels. At the same time, we've reduced our consumption of oil by 1 million barrels. So with an increase in production of 1 million, a decrease in consumption by 1 million, we've been able to reduce overall by 2 million barrels our imports from the rest of the world. But you hit upon some key things. Shale is more expensive. The wells are more shallow. They peak much faster. And we are running faster and faster in place. And one of the reasons we're talking about energy prices the way they are today is the difficulty the energy industry is. It's running harder to keep up with demand. And that's why we see these energy spikes anytime we see an improvement. I mean, the United States is growing at an anemic rate of 1.5%. The world global economic growth is at an anemic rate. It has fallen. And yet look where oil prices are. That should tell you all you need to know. And there was an interview I did with Professor Oliver Inderwildi from Oxford University, and they just did a study, and probably the most comprehensive study that I've seen on peak oil, the future, and all shale has done is bought us maybe another 10 years. And what I mean by that is we know that conventional oil peaked in 2005. The shale oil has put the peak out a little bit further because we are now making up the difference between a flattening or declining conventional oil production with unconventional oil, which is tar sands, shale, and deep water, and Arctic oil. And there's no way. This is just absolute nonsense that we're going to be energy independent in 5 years. It's not going to happen.
Hi, Jim and John. This is Larry from Texas. Just wanted to give you both a big thank you for the Global Warming Forum last week. It was great. Good to hear the other side. Thank you.
Larry, appreciate the comment. Because you hear so much of a one-sided issue, what we thought we'd do in this debate is bring the other side of the issue. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
This is Larry from Northern California. Regarding your show on global warming, I noticed that you only presented one side of the argument. And I know in the past you've gone out of your way to consider both sides of an issue, and you didn't in this case, and I'm curious why that is, even if you consider that global warming argument doesn't have any merit, just the fact that so many people believe it does would seem to me that it's at least a controversial issue, a legitimate controversy, and the argument in favor of global warming should have been presented as well, and I'm curious why you didn't, since in the past you've gone to such great lengths to be completely objective on other issues. Thanks very much.
Larry, we frequently run a lot of interviews that are one-sided on all sorts of issues, and we're also known for being contrarian, but it's interesting you mentioned the one lopsidedness because of the government funding in favor of finding man-made global warming to be true as opposed to finding it to be false as being totally one-sided as well. The amount supposedly funded by oil companies pales, believe it or not, in comparison by what the government has funded on the pro side. And if you only fund one side of the investigation, you're going to get very skewed results. It's just like any scientist that's doing an experiment. In fact, scientists who have come out against global warming saw that their government funding dry up, and most notable among them is Dr. William Gray at Colorado State University, who's known nationally for his annual hurricane season storm projections, which the media are always using. You see this a lot on the weather channels as we approach the hurricane season. But a couple of years ago in an interview, he told us as soon as he gave his expert opinion on global warming, his funding dried up almost immediately.
Well, it affects funding. It affects it a lot, particularly when the Clinton administration came on and Gore was put in charge there. I know I got NOAA research money for 30 years. As soon as Clinton administration, I was cut off. And every proposal I sent in was rejected because it was known that I didn't go along with the human-induced greenhouse gases, but also this approach at climate modeling. I didn't agree with that, and I thought the only way you can do it is to look in the past and see how the atmosphere has behaved and see what comes out of certain global conditions that are there now, how they will be there in 3, 6, 9 months, a year later. That's the only way on empirical approach to predicting climate.
So if you want to hear the other side of the argument, read or listen to any of the mainline media, you have it because it's all one-sided. And that's why we did that in the way that we did. We did this once before in 2005 after Katrina and Rita, when the media was just rife with all these global warming stories and horror stories. We were going to die in 10 years, all this kind of stuff. And we did a roundtable discussion with experts, including Dr. William Gray, and we got lambasted for it because we were telling the other side of the story, which is what we like to do when it's all one-sided.
Good afternoon, Jim and John. I hope you guys are having a nice vacation. With regard to the Agenda 21 podcast, you asked an important question that I don't think was ever answered by the panelists, which is, how is Agenda 21 constitutional? That is, how can it trump the Constitution? And I think that's a crucial issue that I commend you for raising, but that I hope will actually be discussed more fully. It is patently clear that no treaty, even a treaty signed by the President and ratified by the Senate, can itself trump the Constitution. There are numerous arguments with respect to that point, but a number of them would include, number one, that the Senate approval of any treaty and the actual process of the treaty's adoption is subject to the authority of the Constitution, expressly in the Constitution. Number two, if a treaty could override the Constitution, then the amendment process for the Constitution itself in Article 5, for example, if the Senate and the President actually signed a treaty that trumped the Constitution, they would be in violation of their sworn oaths of office, since those oaths require them to uphold and defend the Constitution, not subordinate the Constitution to foreign adopted law. Anyway, I hope you can find somebody who's knowledgeable about this, because too many people of every political persuasion seem to think that the Constitution can be trumped by treaty, and that's just emphatically not the case. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point that you raise, because the Constitution does say when we sign treaties, the contents of the treaty become the law of the land. And the question is, do they supersede the Constitution itself? And as you said, that's an issue of debate. And Jim, we could probably do something in that in the future. Usually, when we sign a treaty, say UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, UN Convention on the Rights of Human Rights, etc., we put reservations in there. All countries do, which means, well, we agree with everything except, and then we list those, and then that applies. But to ask how also, and this I'm throwing this in on top of what you said, how this could be implemented is what has happened, especially after the Biodiversity Treaty flubbed coming out of the United Nations Conference on Environment and Development, what our various organs of government have done at the national level and state and local level is say, well, we really don't care that it was never ratified as a treaty. We are just going to implement the provisions of the treaty by making it law in our city or in our county or in the country. And that's what the EPA is doing and other governmental agencies. They've just taken all these ideas and brought them right in and are enforcing them largely through regulation. Locally, it comes into your home area as something called smart growth or comprehensive planning or comprehensive growth. It comes in with all sorts of names. It's brought into town. Your county officials say, this is your plan. It really isn't. It's being brought in by one of these non-governmental organizations that are well-trained with change agents and facilitators to put this whole thing through like grease lightning. It's very hard to fight. And once you get it, it should be called no growth, because that's its ultimate purpose. The theory being that if we could stop growth, we can save the planet. But they just don't tell you that up front. And a lot of counties are trying to fight it. A lot of counties that have passed it regret it, and they're trying to get it out. And so that's how it comes about. But you are right. That would probably be a good conversational topic, Jim, for a future show. Like, can you really do this or not? Because we have other treaties coming through. The Law of the Sea just did another flub in the Senate. But there are other treaties out there pending. And a lot of political groups here in this country who couldn't get their agendas through by passing it through state legislatures or the National Congress have discovered, oh, look at this. If we can just do it in a treaty, why, we can force everybody to do it. We can force all 50 states to do it at once, instead of having to do it piecemeal, state by state.
Elizabeth from Pennsylvania. I have a question regarding some discussion of the U.S. going back to a gold standard. And if we did, what would that do to the price of gold? Thanks a lot.
Elizabeth, we're probably going to go, it's my opinion, we're heading back to a gold standard as all these fiat currencies collapse, because we're in the end game now. with the degree of monetization. It would be a revaluation of the currency, whether the United States does it on its own initiative or it's forced or it tries to head it off. It would drive the price up of gold tremendously, because just like when Roosevelt confiscated gold back in 1933, he revalued or devalued the dollar by 60%. I suspect the price of gold would skyrocket.
Wayne from Delaware, I'd like to thank you guys for the great show. A few years ago, you had a guest on, Charles Adams, and I read his book at least four times over the course of the years, and I'm on it again, and it's better. It's history, and history is repeating itself, whole history of man. And my question is, could you have this man back if he's still alive? And thank you for your show, all you do. God bless you.
You know, Wayne, I'll have to check and see. I know he did a conference. I believe he's still living. Let me suggest another book, because Charles Adams' book, When Money Dies, is one of my favorites. And the other one, which is out in paperback now, because this used to be rare, it's called Dying of Money by Jens O. Parson. That's Jens, J-E-N-S, separate initial O, last name Parson, P-A-R-S-S-O-N, and that is a pen name for a Boston lawyer who wrote that back in the 70s. I got an email from his son. His name was Mr. Marks, but this was his pen name because his book was so controversial. But Dying of Money and When Money Dies are two of my favorite books, as well as Bresciani Tarroni's book on the economics of inflation. But boy, if you really liked When Money Dies by Adam Ferguson, may I strongly suggest it's available in paperback while you can still get it, because the prices are now going up. Dying of Money. It used to be much, much cheaper, but they're getting harder to find. My suggestion, grab them when you can. I have an original copy that I paid $300 for that's worth thousands. So I would strongly suggest this.
Now, wait a minute. There we go with the names again. You're going to trust something written by a guy named Marx?
No, I said Jens O. Parsons. That was his pen name, dude. You're still stuck on the fib guy, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm still stuck on the fib guy. Yeah. But I'm thinking about nachos now because of Fibonacci.
Nachos and Fibonacci.
Well, here we are, unfortunately, back again. I can't roam around the West like I was doing. Grousy, grousy, grousy. But we're going to have some exciting shows between now and the end of the year. I think things are going to get really dicey as we move towards the elections. There's a lot of speculation now, I've noticed, in the intelligence publications about the situation in Iran. But, of course, 2013 promises to be an important year. There were a couple of important articles, by the way, Jim, that came out during the time we took off. One from Ambrose Evans Pritchard at the Telegraph in London, and he's always been a very sober op-ed writer there, and he is basically saying the day of cheap oil is over. Peak cheap oil is what he's calling it, regardless of what the supply happens to be out there still in the world. The other article came out, said 2013 is going to be a real year of crisis because of the food shortages being generated by a number of different factors, among them drought. So it promises to be the beginning of the sled ride into 2014 and 2015.
Election years are always interesting, John, because whether the economy is doing well or isn't doing well as it is right now, it always makes for interesting news, because you have all these statistics, all these stories. If you elect me, I'm going to, stop global warming. If you elect me, I'm going to create jobs. I'm going to do this and all these stories. And hopefully in the weeks ahead, we're going to take these stories and try to frame the real issues that we should be talking about. One of them, which was the topic of this week's big picture, is $16 trillion in counting. People don't realize how important that number is, because now the debt is starting to grow exponentially. We've got debt growing faster than economic growth, and that's always dangerous, which is why you're hearing all this talk about money printing. But coming up next week, we're going to take a different track with our Lifetime Income series. We are going to have two experts on the program, an estate tax attorney on the program, and also a trust officer, because there are a lot of things that we're going to have to deal with. If nothing happens January 1st, the exemption, the amount that you can pass tax-free drops from $5 million down to $1 million, and the estate tax rate goes from 35% to 55%. So we're going to have a tax planning attorney on the program. And then also one of the big issues that a lot of couples face in retirement is, who do you name as successor trustee if you have a trust? And we're going to have a corporate trustee. We're going to talk about the issues of incapacity, the problems with family members, and all of the issues that you really need to address when you're talking about leaving any kind of legacy to your heirs, nephews, whoever you want to leave it to. So double interview next week on the program. You don't want to miss it. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense NewsHour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
And subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.